So why don't you take us away, Renee?
All right, welcome everybody. We are doing a special live edition of Debug at Ool Conference, a wonderful conference in Ireland. Joining me as always, my co-host Guy English. How are
Hello.
You?
Hello, I'm pretty good, thank you.
It's a good conference.
So far so good. Yeah. And we'll see how this turns out.
Also joining us is Horace Dedia from Asimco. How are you, Horace?
Oh, I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for being here.
Well, it's great to meet you finally, Guy. Yeah, I mean, we've been on two shows at least.
Yeah. It's always a lot of fun to talk to you.
So. Yeah, excellent.
Finally get to drag you on my show.
I only know you by the way your Twitter little avatar thing.
That's about like 20 years out of date too.
Yeah, I can tell.
You are much more handsome than your triangle.
Oh yeah. A lot less red. Anyway.
So as we were just discussing just before we started recording, generally we sort of go through a little bit of background and then we'll talk about what's going on currently. And you gave a talk earlier today here at Ool about the generations of humanity and corporations and how they roughly line up in 30-year segments. Mm-hmm. At the top of that talk, you mentioned that you were happy to be here at Ool because you'd started out as a developer. Mm-hmm. What kind of plan was? Did you start out at Nokia?
Because I know no. So that tells you just how old I am because I started out in '80s. Okay. Actually, in '89, though officially, I was already a sort of professionally developing rather than as a student. So I was writing code in a research lab in '89. So this was a company called GTE.
Thank you.
which no longer exists as such. It's now called Verizon, but it was because of the GT was a telecom company that was serving strange places, including Indiana. But it was
I'm from Montreal.
I know.
Okay.
I know. I'm just saying Indiana because it's in the news lately.
Oh, okay.
So the thing was that it was a mostly rural company, so it was dealing with mostly properties out in the boonies, and then they got merged with a much more sort of urban, which was the Bells, New England area and south. Anyway, so long story, I was in telecom, but I was coding for a research project in the late 80s, early 90s. And the project was in an area of research or an area of computer science theory called information retrieval. And information retrieval is what came to be known as search. And we were looking at search problems and how to form natural language queries in that time frame. So actually, I kind of was part of thinking about search a decade at least before it became commercially viable. We didn't know what to apply it for. In fact, one of the interesting things was like Yellow Pages was the product that these companies had. And so we were thinking about how to search Yellow Pages for the ad you wanted to, or the business you wanted. And, rather than structuring it as alphabetical, or which is how you used to search Yellow Pages, or by the categories they defined of businesses, you could do free search. So that was how I began. That was my start in my career.
And this is obviously before you have the benefit of cross-referencing that PageRank becomes in, right?
Right. PageRank didn't emerge until, obviously, the Internet emerged. And so while I was there, we were looking at there was a sort of an early hypertext that was being looked at for purposes of markup and
like
purposes of this HTML.
Kind of stuff, like
it was actually the Oxford English Dictionary was one of the first things that was processed using this technology. Mm-hmm. It was an effort out of Toronto, out of Ottawa somewhere, or I forget exactly, it was in Canada.
Ottawa,
yeah. There was a research project there to index the Oxford English Dictionary. Mm-hmm. And so you could find all the scholarly type of research you could do on the Oxford Dictionary, which is, by the way, 300 volumes or something like that. It's enormous. So that was one of the applications because we were developing search, and another one was actually in the military, which I didn't get involved with, but they were trying to do search on all the stuff they were collecting. Obviously, they're still doing that.
Yeah,
a little bit.
So out of that, where do you go from there?
So I left after frustration because that was going nowhere. Right. So I knew search was dead. That was finished.
Yeah. Did it feel like AI? Like in the next 10 years, we'll have search. Like we'll always have AI in the next 10 years.
The next 20 at the time, I think it was more like seeing like that was the... So the AI, this was we didn't aspire to be called AI because it was a real AI lab next to the one we were in. But those guys were using connection machines, and they were using Lisp and Prolog and stuff like that, and we were just using C, so we couldn't obviously be calling ourselves AI researchers.
I meant it more as a comparable effort to attain some kind of.
It's always coming, but it's never arriving.
Right, right. Oh yes. So IR. I mean, the problem was that we got a pretty good answer. I mean, we weren't using the types of algorithms that we use today. But at the time, full text retrieval was possible. It's just a question: how do you determine rank? Mm-hmm. So you have many heuristics. One of which happened to be popular with PageRank, but there are others which were viable at the time, which were based on heuristics of proximity of words and placement within the page. Whether the citation was frequent or not, and so on. So there were different ways of looking at rank. But then I left it because there were no commercial applications for it. That was the problem. It was so early that having an index into a library system, which was one thing I worked on, having an index into Yellow Pages, these were just very niche applications and looked to be stuck in the ghetto of a research lab. So I thought of sort of learning more about the world and how it works, and that was why I wanted to get out of research and do something more mainstream. And at the time, all I managed to do was go to Wall Street, or nearby anyway.
One of your things that you, it's effectively your current mission statement, I'd say, is learning to ask the right questions. Was that sort of impetus, like at the core of that decision to leave sort of a pure, or what you felt at the time was a pure research field and go into something practical?
No, it was, I didn't have the ambition to ask the right questions at the time. I had just the ambition to have fun and also I wanted to, as far as a career was concerned, I didn't think research labs were the place to be because I didn't see the people who you met there had been there a long time and they just were not making a large impact on the world. Mm-hmm. I mean, some of course did historically, the Carnegie and Ritchie and all those guys who developed Unix and C, those guys came out of research labs, but they were very few relative to the thousands who were employed there. So instead I thought, even within the company that employed me, the people who were in management were people who had come through the business units. Mm-hmm. So my thought was either I go into a telecom business unit or I might, develop knowledge about business somewhere else. And I ended up getting recruited. It was totally due to one of these corporate recruiters that called me up and cold called me and said, would you like to go to New York? And I interviewed for a job at Chase. And but I didn't know much about it. I just thought it would be glamorous to go to New York.
So that's great. I don't know if you can talk about what you were doing at Chase at the time.
Very little. I mean, we were using Lotus Notes, and they were just rolling out this pretty mundane technology. But it was something that was, very advanced for the time for a bank. And actually, I went there with sort of the hope of bringing some of the things I had learned in the research lab. So those things included using Unix. Mm-hmm. So I had a workstation and a Mac, and I didn't have a PC while I was working in 1989 in this lab. So we had also very embryonic internet, although it wasn't the web. It was internet using Gopher, using Usenet, using FTP, and these were tools that were useful for different things. And so the logic of it was maybe I could bring some of that Unix-like stuff to a bank to see what they could do with it. I mean, Sun was selling some systems into banks at the time. Yeah.
Workstation days, right?
Yeah, it was actually some workstations were already on the rocks by then, like Apollo. Apollo was starting to crash. IBM was getting into it with AIX.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
DEC was in it with DEC Station.
Next is the next year?
Next was getting in. But, if you were really a power user of computers, you'd gravitate towards that level of machine, not a PC. Right. And so although I had a PC in college, I was doing professionally work only on workstations. Mm-hmm. And again, so it felt like a step backwards to go back into a PC world, and a PC world that was not only using whatever they were using, I forget whether they were HP or something like it, but they were a token ring. They were not even using Ethernet. Right. So it was a very archaic system, because a bank is kind of half, you know, mm-hmm. stepping half out of the mainframe world. You know, is not, one foot was still there. So they were still with IBM for a lot of stuff.
What was the net, not NetBIOS, NetWare?
Yeah, I forget, but my job was actually to manage a small team that was developing mm-hmm. apps in Lotus, because Lotus had a development environment. Yeah. So we were building a bunch of business, what we might call today, you know, business processes implemented in Lotus Notes, and it was really pretty horrible. I left after about a year and a half,
okay.
But only because I got accepted to business school. I don't know what would have happened to me if I hadn't been, but that's the world I was in.
Sounds kind of bleak. So your interest in, where does your interest in business processes come? Was it from working? It seems like the software you were developing was unsatisfying to you.
Right,
like,
but I didn't really.
Problems you were solving, like,
I didn't start to understand the world in any way until probably a few years after business school. Because okay. what happened is, as I explained it once, I think in the first podcast I ever did, was that I went to business school actually with the interest of learning how business works. And I think, because as an engineer, you sort of learn the axioms of the sciences. And then you start to have a deterministic view of the world. So you think that there's cause and effect that well understood for most, you know, the bulk of the problems that exist. And so the thing was that I thought there might be such a set of rules for business that I just was not exposed to. Mm-hmm. And so I never, because I had to get several engineering degrees under my belt in my education, I didn't have time for the social sciences, I didn't have time for economics, I didn't have time for any of these other although I did a few liberal art things, which were very, very useful, but I didn't do any social science stuff.
Right. It's a discrete solution.
I thought business was really the combination of economics, psychology, and finance. And so that, you know, finance would be more mathematical, psychology would be a social science that also has its own axioms. And then, so I thought you would go to business school to learn those and put them together like bricks in a Lego thing. And
then you get the answer.
Yeah, and then you get the answer. And then there was a little turnkey. But it turned out that it was very not unsatisfying to go to business school, because it really didn't, they didn't have any answers at all to anything. I don't know, this sounds funny, but to people who didn't go through the program, but it's so true that really there is no science of management.
Yeah.
So then I said, actually, instead of turning this into a negative, let's turn it into a positive. That means there's a lot of problems that can still be solved. So at first I got the education in sort of knowing what I don't know and what's not known. And the next stage would have been, okay, let's go see if we can find some answers to stuff like this. For the first few years, though, I wasn't really going into that. I was trying to pay off my loans, and so I also, we had this thing called the internet, which I use in air quotes, that began while I was doing this. So mm-hmm. so I had initially, right after business school, I decided to do some startup work, and actually that carried me through till 2001.
Okay.
And there's a long story there, but I did two startups, and I went back to software development, which was very unusual for MBAs to do. I mean, I'd say 90% of those who graduated with me went to either consulting or finance. Nowadays, they probably do go into more into startups. But when I was telling my classmates, I said, I'm thinking to do a startup. They said, well, you went to the wrong school. No one for graduating from Harvard Business School does startups. End of story. And so. You know, maybe Babson or something like that. Mm-hmm. I don't know what colleges did that have an entrepreneurship program. But when I studied these preferences for graduates, I realized that actually what they were doing in terms of finance and consulting had been different 30 years earlier. Mm-hmm. They would have been going into general management, or they would have wanted to become the CEO of General Motors. So that would have been the ambition level in the 1950s. Now, somehow that shifted to consulting primarily, and then more finance later, and then a mix of startups even after that. So you could see, because the MBA program also sort of, there's a huge herd mentality that goes through. Mm-hmm. Everybody's like knowing what the hot thing is, and so they all want to rush into it. And so there's this group thing that goes on. It's shameful.
So is sort of that, again, the number 30 comes up, which we'll get to in a bit. Do you think there's a generational frequency of about 30 years, and that applies to the, you know, the structure for the academic course load and what's being learned? Back to business.
If you go back a century, 30 seems to be a good generational breakpoint. What I'm curious is whether that's shrinking with respect to business.
Because technology is increasing the speed of communication, therefore, like there's faster.
It's a couple of reasons. So I used to give a talk last year. I gave a talk that I would call Lifespans, which is actually showing the overlaying of the technology adoption curves on the human lifespans, which are actually increasingly longer. So the human lifespans is sort of like, because of life expectancy, you can predict them. Yeah. So when you look at technology lifespans, they're actually getting shorter. So the pattern was only visible. I only had 20 data sets for technologies. I have now about 40. But the idea was that you could, if you just juxtapose the fact that technologies, which by the way lead to industries, so in the entire creation of a new industry, really, these are very, very iconic technologies like automobiles, internet, or television in general. Yeah, so it would have been not just that the TV set, it would have been a whole industry built on the content and everything else that came with it. So there were three generations of televisions, black and white color, HD, and those three, you can easily map them on a. So the interesting thing was that in the early 20th century, things took a lot longer than they do today, although there are some exceptions. The cars today still are very slow to get replaced, right? So you don't have an eight-year replacement cycle for technologies for cars, nor for electric grids, nor for governments, nor for education, nor for healthcare. In fact, sometimes you ask yourself, is tech the anomaly to a society that actually moves very slowly, or are those actually becoming the slow things, are those the anomalies to a new engine of growth, which is technology? Because if you know, it's all about changing your point of view and perceptions.
Well, it's because those are technologies that have effectively stabilized, like, you know, the width of bridges and roads going back to Roman times. Like, if we kind of just accepted that, well, these problems are solved enough, and therefore we don't need to change them anymore.
Well, so what happens is that's why I talk about this in sort of. People's perceptions change once things saturate or once things reach a good enough state. And so they're no longer hungry for change. Or if they are, they're asking for stuff which is actually no one will want. So flying cars are actually not really feasible, not so much for technical reasons, but because the current cars are actually good enough. And the trade-offs you're going to need to make are not worth it for going into a new dimension. So there is this problem that people's ambition level drops. And then also, I call it this, there's a time when you make pies, there's a time when you split the pies. So when a society is young, civilization, nation, I don't know how you'd want to define society, but some often in the very beginning, it's a frontier mentality. So you saw that in the United States, in fact, several times over, because the East Coast and the settlements that we went westward, you always had new land, and so those people who occupy the new land would have a different mentality than those who were left behind, and so you had the frontier, and that allowed people to say, "We're going to make pies. We're going to actually build stuff from scratch, and we're going to really redo things in new ways and better ways." So California is built along different lines than the East Coast,
and specifically the automobile. I mean, in the case of LA, I'd argue.
LA, you see, it was built around the car, and so is perhaps Dubai today or certain new cities. Mm-hmm. Now, if you were to ask, what will a city be like in 50 years, I can assure you it's not going to be built around the car, because that won't be as interesting anymore. People will rethink the car by then. But the problem is, so everything is a function of the time and place that things are happening. And I think societies themselves have an S-curve, right? So that you go through a phase of really, really, really eruption, you know, a huge growth. And then things, people get into the pie slicing business. Then they say, well, you know, there's no more pie to be made, so let's cut it up. So then people, special interests start to vie for their piece of it, and then that becomes a rigid society. And you can see how also that happened in Europe, and they're in the pie-cutting mode, and perhaps it happened to the Romans back, 2,000 years ago.
Yeah, quite arguably it did. I mean, with the,
if you ran out of places to conquer, you get into this problem.
Yeah, so you head back over.
Busy work.
Yeah, head back home. one thing I wanted to ask you about, because I want to get back to this pie-cutting aspect in this bit, is you specifically call out technology. But at one point, it votes with technology, and all of these things with technology. Mm-hmm. Is the use of the term technology like sort of a misnomer? Does that distract us from what is actually happening rather than...
To me, it's an enabler or catalyst, and I wish I wouldn't have to use these jargony terms, but there's no other better ones I can think of. So technologies often are, if not causal, they sort of they put the other forces together and allow them to work. And so the forces might be simple human needs. The forces might be, like we talk about, this tendency to want to grow, to want to progress, to want to move forward. Otherwise, you have tendencies to not do those things. And so there are forces that are pulling and pushing it all the time. And when a new technology comes in, it sometimes sparks a new thing, which actually I think this is why disruption happens. Disruption is when new things happen with that catalyst as the enabler. Right, the spark that causes the combustion. Mm-hmm. Now, so historically, you can also see that the introduction of new technologies all the way back to the Roman times would spark a new era, cause a new. So everything, many times it was weapons technologies, metallurgy, gunpowder, ship design, wheel. All these things probably caused empires to be created and destroyed. Mm-hmm. And more recently now, we're seeing that new stuff that's coming in, because it's built more modularly, it's built on top of existing technologies, right? Mm-hmm. So the simplest example is that the smartphone could not have been a phenomenon if there wasn't an internet.
Right.
And the internet could not have happened if there wasn't a PC. And so, and on it goes, you would have had also a telephone network, an electricity grid, a road network, and all of these things are enablers for the things that came on top. And so when you think about the apps that get these very high rates of growth, and everybody's saying that's never happened before, you had 500 million people getting onto an Instagram or whatever, then the reason for that growth is because the infrastructure has been laid and they're standing and leveraging, literally just allowing speed to be faster because of all the stuff that's in place. I don't know if I'm answering a question or where I ended up here.
It doesn't matter. Anyway. We're having good conversations, so who cares? one thing to note is that, so this S-curve notion, and with that in mind, the Mac is 30 years old.
Yeah.
And the pie-cutting notion. And if we kind of bring a lot of these together, as the Mac seems like it's done its S-curve, and we're in pie-cutting mode a little bit with that, and that's enabled the next one, which is iOS. And eventually that will, we assume, follow a similar pattern and get into S-curving mode. Is Apple itself in pie-cutting mode?
Good question. So that's where the theory becomes useful, because prescriptive rather than just descriptive. So the description of the phenomenon is what I've done so far, which is, let's use this metaphor of the pie or the S curve, which is in the beginning is when it forms, it's a creation mode, and then when it saturates, it's a cutting mode. So people try to carve out their piece of it, because on those population data, I didn't present this, but I would overlay technology adoptions, literally showing all those people who are colored in their age groups, but it would just have a monochromatic view, and then you could see red being non-consumption and blue being consumption, and you could actually sweep over and say, boom, there it happened, TV, and so it goes from all red to all blue within like 10 years. Or if it's slow, it goes gradually, there's sort of a lot of pink in the middle and so on. So, but the idea is that, therefore, that, yes, that's the metaphor that you have that. So if we look at Apple, I think what the balancing act is that you'll do the Mac you'll play the game correctly means we're in the creation mode. Let's work all the levers of control we have available so that we optimize for that. And then at the end, let's play the levers differently. So you play your cards differently when you are past the point of inflection in the S-curve, right? So you know, do a derivative, and it's like there's an obvious peak point, right, of growth. So knowing where you are, and it's not so obvious because there are multiple markets. You have the U.S., and you could study that S-curve, and then suddenly you think you're done. But in fact, China's out there. You saw the size of it. So you say, well, you're only at the beginning in China. So do we change our strategy because the U.S. is getting saturated? This happens now with the iPhone. Or do we actually double down and actually the game hasn't even started? So because Apple is... And most companies have one product for the whole world. You can't discriminate and start. Sure. You know, you're going to have arbitrage, people buying it cheap in one place and selling it in another. So there are limits to that. But yes, the thing is that you need to manage it carefully and be aware of where you are. Now, does Apple do this? I think this sounds very, very kind of very, this very management thinking kind of thing. And I would, Apple doesn't usually behave that way. They simply want to do, as they say, make the best products. So I'm wary of the notion not being what they do, right? But in a sense, the result of all their thinking about what makes a great product somehow fits with this strategy because they're evolving the product. And this phase of the Mac, 30 years on, it is amazingly great product. And as a result, it's gaining share. So they're working on being great at a time when everybody's working on being more and more mediocre. Mm-hmm. And as a result, they're winning. Now, at a time when the industry was erupting, they were working on being great, but everybody else who was working on being mediocre was getting the volume advantage, right? Mm-hmm. And so that's how you get market share loss. But in the long term, actually, it's a winning strategy. So Apple somehow ended up being the last man standing, as I pointed out, as Phil Schiller said, that there's no one left standing from the time when they started in this business. And so in a way, what is winning? What is winning in this game? And that's why I use lifespans and generally thinking about, if you look at things more like biologically, that things are born and things die, whether it's a company, a product, a technology, or a person, you start to think, well, what are you optimizing for? I think most people want to optimize for great life, long life. We understand that intrinsically, but when we have organizations which are complex, they lose sight of those things. And the individual incentives that are at work for individuals don't have any optimization along longevity, right? They're all about getting things done in the short term. Yeah. And so you end up with imbalances which cause the failure. So I think what's interesting about Apple, and I always like to study Apple because I think it's the most anomalous thing in the world. It's very anomalous in not following the rules that are established by all these pattern matchers. And so is being focused as they are on greatness sufficient, without any other caveats, to solving this dilemma of longevity, to solving the dilemma of being prosperous over time?
Well, is not the solution to longevity evolution, effectively? And with that in mind, previously you spoke about television, effectively three stages, black and white, color, and HD. A current HD TV has nothing in common with black and white or even color televisions. So has that product just not... Is it a misnomer to call it television? And is it a misnomer to call, like, the new MacBook...
A Mac.
MacBook. Yeah. Mac. Is it the Mac anymore? Or is
that's
it,
a good point.
Is
that's
it
a
like
good
a different
point.
Animal?
It has evolved.
It's a different beast, right?
So even we... Yes, that's a great point, because even though we as persons, once we go from baby to old age... We evolved dramatically, and we call that going through school, having the school of hard knocks in real life, having
infancy, toddlership,
these are very dry. I mean, the idea is that what you learn matters.
Oh, okay.
As you go along in life, your evolution is actually predicated, I believe, on your ability to learn, and that causes you to change. Someone said learning another language is like getting a second soul. I mean, learning another profession or learning, retraining yourself is like gaining another life. It's really becoming, you know, truly. So those people who have full lives go through multiple processes of learning. And so what I think is you're right is that a company or a product has to evolve in order to have a healthy long life. And in fact, the most difficult thing to do to learn as for business is to redefine itself as a business model, because at the core of all businesses is a profit formula. Let's use these terms like algorithm. There's a profit algorithm, and that profit algorithm is probably the most difficult to change. There's around it, there are priorities, which you then put it to incentives, and around that there's processes, and around that there's resources, or put it another way, resources are inputs, processes are the methods of doing things, and then the purpose is this profit algorithm. In a sense, the purpose is actually the specification of the program. Why are we doing these things? Mm. Now, to change a business's why rather than the how and the who, that is the hardest thing to do, which needs to happen because technology will change, will come into the world, will force you to actually flip into your, suddenly things are no longer tenable the way they used to be, right? So that's my point about that. Yes,
to that point, does that not speak towards your point when Apple dropped the computer from its name? Mm. It seems like that was a very. I know a lot of people freaked out at the time because they thought, was it just iPods at the time? But I mean, they thought that Apple was going to.
It's very subtle, as usual. Yeah. The things are not. It sounds simple in theory, but in practice, right. It's complicated because you say, some would argue that at this point, they say, well, hang on, Apple's always made money by selling pieces of hardware, so nothing's changed about their algorithm. But if you start to look a little bit deeper, you realize that. Yeah, that's how they capture money, but it's not what the value that they deliver. So what they've been changing is the value they deliver and capturing it in a way of sort of, you know. So what do I mean by this? Well, more and more software, more and more services. These were not things they did before. So with the iPod came the notion that, yes, we're going to make it on the hardware, but we're going to sell an experience, a ecosystem, a store, a way of living with music, which caused behavioral change in society. People began to run with these earbuds and you know, do exercise and do all kinds of things that they didn't do, didn't hire music for. Yeah. And so the thing that, as they learned that, say, okay, I think I can almost see the gears turn from 2001 till 2005, saying, okay, we are in a different business now. Right. And with maybe a business that Steve Jobs dreamed about in the 90s, or even the 80s, that he envisioned it, but it finally became viable at that time and very pragmatically got to it. And so, and then the next phase was the iPhone and sort of learning how to build an ecosystem of millions of developers, learning how to actually create on top of that platform a huge stacks of innovation. Platforms are about collaborative innovation. The platform owner contributes something, and then those on top of the platform contributes yet more. And as a result, it's not about inventing one thing. It's about inventing a million things. And so suddenly, the explosion of things you could hire the product for just went crazy. And again, this has its roots in the PC and the software industry of the 80s and 90s. Mm-hmm. But somehow, Apple finally got the ecosystem gene, which was in the old days with the PC, was actually a collaborative effort between Microsoft, Intel, the PC guys, and the software guys. They were building applications. And so that world, Apple somehow almost squeezed into itself. Mm-hmm. And that really was a very powerful transformation of the whole company, and therefore, as you said, evolution, and allows it to have a long life.
Is there a risk that false value is created? We've seen the quick rise and fall of many apps, like Meerkat being I don't want to sound.
Has it fallen already?
Well, I don't know. Well, that's what I've been told.
But while you're on vacation.
Because Periscope came out and Periscope was touched.
Oh, yes,
so Periscope. Twitter, so effectively their legs got cut out from under them, right?
Okay.
And then, like, I mean, that's a very short half-life, right?
Yeah.
2 months ago, you would have said, like, Apple. Not you would have said, one would have said that Apple captured a lot of value in the massive uptake in Meerkat, which is like a new, wow, you can video live. Like that's interesting.
And again, but like I'm streaming live from my Kick on my Nokia N95. I mean, it's not a...
No, but
it's an iteration of
my question really goes towards is like, are these fad apps? And I use that. I don't mean to be derogatory to a lot of apps, but a lot of apps come in and go out reasonably quickly, especially given a 30-year timescale. Like, is that true value or is it? I don't know how to make the distinction. So there's true value and perceived value, right? And is perceived value ephemeral, where it'll can just
vanish? There is value, but we have to be careful. So here's the way to think about it. As part of my previous year's talk, it was about, I said, lifespans. And one thing I looked at is that, let's step back a century and look at the car industry. The car industry was born 1898 with 1886. 1886 was the patent granted for the internal combustion engine-based Motorwagen, which was a German invention. But it was not until 1914 that 10% of any country's population had a car, and that was the United States with Henry Ford's Model T. So you had a span of some 30 plus years again between invention and sort of the hockey stick, as they call it, which is the high speed adoption curve. And that, by the way, that curve lasted all the way until 1990, and you had saturation over long 75 years. But what I pointed out was our overlaid on top of that is the number of startups. Now, we don't think of car companies as startups today, except for Tesla. But I mean, I went on Wikipedia and I found that there was a list of defunct auto companies in the United States. And I went through that list and I picked up the year was created and the year it became defunct. And that list is over 1,100 companies. Wow. So there were 1,100 companies in the United States alone making cars. And then I graphed their entry and exit points and overlaid it on the adoption curve. And sure enough, there was a huge boom prior to Henry Ford's takeoff and sort of a massive collapse in after that curve was joined. So you had essentially four left only a decade or two after that inflection point for the car, right? Well before saturation. So what was the
Cambrian explosion kind of thing? They'd like try a bunch of stuff and ended like...
Yes, there was a Cambrian explosion and then a mass extinction event. Mm-hmm. And the point about it was that, you know, this looked like the internet, right? It looked like the dot-com era. Now, you could ask, did they create any value, those startups in the car business? It looked like a lot of waste. Well, you know, and in fact, in socialist or maybe communist economies, they actually avoid that waste. They say, well, we're going to appoint a company to be the car-making company. They're going to have a monopoly, and we're going to, you know, guide their progress. But it turns out that this experimental phase is crucial because it was out of that phase that emerged the model of the Ford Model T, which meant that it was about mass production. Nobody knew that. Maybe everybody thought that rich people would be the only ones buying cars for 30 years. That was the business model of cars. Rich people can only afford them. And you'd make them by hand. You'd separate the chassis production from the coachwork. And so you'd have different manufacturing. It was more modular. And so Ford said, no, we got to figure out how to make these things fast, and we're going to make them cheap, and we're going to make them so that everybody can afford it. And that was the key to making that curve take off. So had he not done that, would there be a car industry today? Possibly. Maybe it would have been evolving much later, though, and out of Germany instead of the United States, or who knows where else. Now, the point I would make, though, is that I would say there's a huge value in that experimental phase. And this is the same thing that happened with the dot-com era. Now, though we only a few survived, and we celebrate their survival, we celebrate their success. But I say let's celebrate pets.com because, you know, they failed, but they taught us a lot. You know, and we learn from those failures quite a bit. I always say that you learn most from failure. So it's painful for a lot of people, but as a society, we benefit, I think.
So on the App Store, Apple would be the society in which the citizens being the apps are either succeeding or failing based on their experiences. The value would be to Apple, right? So whether or not
Apple is in a great position because they're as a platform. So the platform business didn't really emerge as a business model. I mean, maybe even not even the railroads were really platforms because there was a sort of an integration between the locomotive maker and the rail maker, and so platforms as a business emerged actually. We have to be grateful to Microsoft for having kind of shown the way there, partly even to IBM. But the idea was that this is how software is best made because we got to go fast. That was the main incentive there. Things are changing so quickly. We don't have time. We don't have the skills in-house. IBM cannot make great software, so we're going to let somebody else do it. So that idea of modularizing was what allowed this to happen. So what Apple, the great thing about a platform is essentially you just put it out there and people build on top, and then you get, basically they pay rent to you. And that's that's just, you know, that's like in the Monopoly game. You know, it's a great business model. And if you can gain a platform as a you can actually build that, it's a great business. But you got to stay on top of it, because what happens with typically with platforms is that they like Microsoft's, they just didn't manage them properly into the next generation of computing. And that's where it's actually, like I think it was, again, Jobs who said, you know, in the monopoly, typically monopolies don't have long lives. They implode. And that comes from hubris. It comes from losing sight of these, of the way things are changing, and just become addicted to the rent.
To go back to what you said previously, is that when companies mistake their products for their business? Like, they get good at making one thing and they just become laser focused on making that one thing, even if they end up writing it into the ground?
Yeah, so this is the pathology of the incumbent, that they tend to optimize so much because they're trying to. So the optimization problem is not for longevity. The optimization question is around optimizing the capture of value, right? So if you think about it, it makes a lot of sense. So you'd say, well, let's make the best the product that meets the needs of the most people. Let's make sure we get that distributed to as many of them as we can, and put the incentives in place for that to happen. And so who wouldn't want that strategy? It sounds phenomenal, right? Every major company does this, and you'll see the pain points of anyone who doesn't. Anyone who doesn't, you know, they're going to get a call from somebody in some country that doesn't have service and so on. They say, why were you treating us so badly? Why don't you get some iPhones to us here in Czech Republic or what have you? And then Apple says, you know, we'll get to it eventually. So they're not in any hurry, and that really causes frustration, and people say Apple's stupid to do so. But the weird thing is that somehow it works better that way for them. And so the Samsung strategy and the Nokia strategy and Microsoft strategies of sort of like covering the world with their stuff works to a point, but then you've got a huge army of people who've been incentivized to do that over and over and over again, and you just feed product into this pump that just puts it out there in the millions of points of purchase, and then you realize that you've optimized for the wrong thing, because as technology invariably changes, this army is not equipped to deal with that. You've got to change all your resources, processes, and priorities in order to deal with it. By then, you're so big that you can't move that anymore. You can't shift the strategy.
You're selling them phones, not iPhones, which is a very different business.
Yeah, so you're listening very carefully to your best customers, which are mobile operators. You're listening very carefully to your most demanding customers, who are usually, you know, those who blog about it. And then you say, okay, do you like it? If you know, and you build for them, and you build for them over and over again, and eventually you're overshooting what people really need, and so you become vulnerable to it and disrupt. This is classic.
Your background that we skipped is that you were an analyst, I believe, at Nokia.
So after I did the startup, because we had one successful exit from that, which was to Adobe of all people. I went to Nokia in 2001 because I had an itch, which was about this mobile. About 1999, I thought that all computers would be handheld, right? So, in fact, my second company was called Handheld Media, and my idea was to develop content for mobile computers. As you can imagine, you know, like throughout my life, I've been 10 years ahead, and as a result, a big loser. So
just at the stage, what was Nokia's product line at the time you went there?
So the Communicator, which some of you may remember, was a brick-sized product, that the first version of which was black and white. And that was their first sort of mobile computer type product with a keyboard, and it was going to go to color, that was known, and it was going to go to a high DPI screen. Already in 2001, they were dealing with 200 pixels per inch resolution in color. And full keyboard, and for the fastest network, the best in every way.
They made a lot of money off SMS for a long time.
Well, not with that one so much. I mean, the people still use the T9 keyboard, but this had a full-size keyboard. But it was a PC form factor, kind of very thin, and so problematic form factor, as it turns out. But that, when I saw that, I said, oh, this is a great terminal, meaning in the sense of a media consumption device. And I said, these guys are way ahead of anybody in the United States. If anyone was slightly better, maybe it was Japan. But at the time, the United States was so far behind in terms of mobile technology that I felt I wouldn't learn anything staying there. So I went to Europe to just really try to be part of the mobile revolution in 1990, well, by then 2000, 2001.
Is it fair to say that Nokia fell into the trap, the strategy trap that you were describing previously?
Yeah, so right. So I go there thinking we're going to change the world, and these guys were selling millions and millions of units, obviously far higher numbers than PCs were sold already by then. So, and I just made the observation that simply that they're all going to be smartphones someday, which again was so very, very, very provocative at the time. And this is 2001, 2002, and so on. And Microsoft also was sniffing around and building their own mobile OS. And so the writing was on the wall. This is going to be a big matchup between Nokia with its own OS and then Microsoft coming in trying to replicate the PC story. So the fight was joined in 2001, and with Microsoft Stinger operating, it was their code name for their operating system. We came with Windows Mobile.
Yeah,
they already had
C,
PDAs.
Yeah.
Remember the Pocket PC?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so the PDA was the sort of embryonic mobile computing environment. It had touchscreen, and Palm was out there also, sort of the odd, sort of a Mac-like product that was kind of coming from left field, and maybe they were going to... And BlackBerry was sort of simmering as well, building up its user base.
Were they just pages at the time, or did they have actual phones?
They didn't have phone. I think it was about 2003 they started making a proper phone. And they famously, they said a very clever thing. They said it's much easier for us to add phone functionality to our text pager than it would be for you phone guys to add messaging or email
BBM.
to your because they didn't have the server side, and also a lot of tricks about the UI that were mysterious, and they were right, because 10 years nobody could do anything close to BlackBerry in terms of performance and productivity. So I observed all this in real time, and I was there 2001 till 2009, and I observed both the rise and fall of a company. So it was a very short time, but you saw this rise and fall. Although they were pretty successful already, but a rise in smartphones and then a fall in smartphones. And that, at the same time, this conspiracy to fail by everybody at the same time, right? Palm fails, and they all get together in a room and say, yeah, we're all going to go down when Apple launches. And so I watched it because I was so, again, a little bit ahead of the curve. I was already getting exasperated by 2005. I was saying, smartphone thing isn't going to work out. I mean, as much as I love it, as much as I've been expecting it to happen, it's not growing as fast. Again, because when you see an S-curve in the beginning, it looks really slow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then you're just waiting for that pivot moment, and then it just doesn't come year after year, and you just get so frustrated. People we have long biological lives, but our careers and so on force us to make decisions. But eventually, I stuck long enough, but what happened was that... when the iPhone came in, the reactions to it were very, very bad, and so I was like, how can you say that? Because this thing is going to be amazing, and I had already become sort of a hobby analyst. It became my hobby to follow Apple. It was not something I was paid for, because nobody cared about Apple at Nokia. There was many stories about the iPod, for example. So the iPod was really the litmus test, because when the iPod came out, It was such a tiny business, right? Hundreds of thousands, or maybe tops, the volumes. And so Microsoft was there with their own, not before Zune, but they had licensing of their Place for Sure, which became two other names before that. But the idea was that, look, you need DRM, you need the codecs, you need a server side, you need all this stuff. We can license all this, so just go forth and make a million different SKUs for for these MP3 or music players, and we're going to do the deal making with the labels and everything else and coordinate it in a very modular way, but it was not integrated. Mm-hmm. And again, all of that played itself out in the MP3 market before it played itself out in the phone market, and you could see how the theory was coming into effect. They were modular at a time when you needed integration. Why? Because they made all their careers on the basis of modularity, winning over integration. So, of course, you got to use the lessons from the 90s in 2000s and on and on. And so only they got figured it out probably by 2010 that they said, we got to go and buy Nokia because we can't do this anymore. And then Google with Motorola. But it doesn't mean that you realize that that's you're on the wrong path. It doesn't mean you get on the right one or even can do so.
Does modularity and integration sort of seesaw between each other?
Again, I think it's part of this S-curve. Yes. So in the early years, also, when you have the need to create more than you need to split, then integration is very important because otherwise you can't go fast enough. You're on that flat trajectory and nothing's picking up. So you got to iterate as quickly as possible to get to that magical solution, like the Ford Model T.
Yeah.
So you're like working it on this way and that way and this way. And that's where sometimes it's internal to the company, sometimes it's external. So all these little integrators are all trying to buying for the right formula. And suddenly you get it right and all the conditions come to play. And then they start marching up. And so as you're quickly accelerating upward, what the theory suggests is that at a later stage it goes modular. So the problem is that the DNA of Apple doesn't permit them to go modular.
Right.
So what's
exactly.
interesting is what they do is they play a slightly different game. They still stay with high quality, high margin, high profit, but they essentially create a new curve. That's the magic. So Apple's strategy is do not change your DNA to fit this flip flop that happens with architecture, business architecture. Rather, let's just create new things all the time, and no one else does that because no one else is integrated. They're the last integrator standing, right? There's no one else who can do integration anymore.
So they accept that the product is eventually going to die. Like there's a lifespan to all things, and as long as they've got.
Yeah, well, you saw the iPod. The iPod already went through that. And the magic of the Mac at 30 is that, indeed, it hasn't yet. But we can see that the overall category is contracting. So what they're saying, we're just going to skim it. And I mean, term for marketing is skimming versus penetration. But so they have a skimming strategy. And they're just going to take all the profits as long as it as. And that's what they did with the iPod. Mm-hmm. And so what you need to do is the good thing about it from an integrator's point of view is they probably are having visibility to a lot of stuff down in the pipeline, like you know UI experiences. So they're looking at. And I always say it's really the triggers for new categories are UI experiences, right? Mm-hmm. So you saw Tim Cook do this is exactly that on screen, and he copied that straight out of the Jobs iPhone launch. And I posted this; it was so obvious that they were doing the tentpole thing. And so when you think about it, there's just no end to this pipeline. I mean, people just said the iPhone, and that's it. There's nothing after it, or nothing as big as the iPhone. Yeah. But I would argue that you don't need to be as big. You can just have, and it's all about UI. It's all about user input, even you could say, rather than interface. It's like, how do we integrate computers into our lives more? And so, you know, we have input methods of scrolling and of touch and possibly gesturing without even touching, and those things are going to are in the labs today, and they're going to be productized. And as they get productized, new platforms form around them.
They further democratize the technology to make it more accessible and add addressable market. Is there an argument to be made that Apple's modularization is external? So things like CarPlay and HomeKit and HealthKit are not marginalizing Apple's products, but they're bringing Apple's products to categories that they could not cover internally?
Yeah, so this is very pragmatic. So CarPlay, I think that this case a module, but I don't think it's going to really work for them to change much as far as the auto industry is concerned. So in some ways it feels like, I was very kind of optimistic, but I realized that the cycle time is so slow in the car industry that we're not going to see progress. So it felt very much like putting iTunes on the rocker, It's got that feeling to it. I mean, it's at the mercy of the integrators. The integration point is outside of Apple's control. Number one, they are on the different clock cycle, and so I point out all the time on the Sim Car, which is my other podcast about cars, is that we're still. You know, I just rented. It's funny. I rented an Audi when I was in California last time. It was a silver car, and in the brand new car. In the glove box, there was a connector for a phone, but it was the old
30-pin.
And so they must have thought, we're the hippest dudes around, right? I mean,
because
they didn't have a cassette player, probably. Yeah.
So previously you said that it was sort of, you know, so long as Apple can keep seeing sort of future input methods and how best to achieve them. They're going to keep building. Is not then the issue with Apple's longevity as a company being a cultural one rather than a technical one?
Oh, geez, do we have another hour on that?
In fact,
this is why these shows go 6 hours. But you don't need to.
Okay, just quickly just on that, because we had a great dinner conversation the other day about the culture a little bit. So I'll just recap some of that. So I've been thinking about this because when you start peeling the onions. Skin layers and so on, that you get to interesting observations. So just observing the fact of, you know, and this this I having spoken to some Apple people, some alums of Apple, this like this functional organization just popped out, and it was like, hang on a second, I hadn't noticed this. This is an open secret, like it's out there in plain sight. You go to their homepage and see the names of the executives, and you realize that their responsibilities are all functional. There's no head of iPhone. Like there would have been a Microsoft head of Windows, there would have been a head of Office, but there's no such thing. So these people are very fine. That's one thing. But the interesting problem with that model, which I explored, was that in a functional organization, incentives are a problem because you got to stay in that role for your whole career. I mentioned this once at one of my air show events, which is a workshop we do when teaching the presentation skills. And I met an Apple person, and I said, what are you doing? He said, I write technical documentation. I said, fantastic. How long have you been in Apple? And he said, I've been, since 90-something. It's like, wow, you've been there a really long time. So what did you do when you started in technical documentation? He's been a tech writer for 25 years. Yeah. And I said, well, and hats off. I say, great. Yeah. Do something you're great at. And I think that is what they've nurtured, but it's very tough if that person doesn't have a passion for it. I mean, if they feel restless after a few years. And so you've got to give them a way to sort of channel their energy into maybe something. Sometimes as a manager, you get pulled into management there, but it's not a simple process. I talked to Don Melton about this once, and he told me just how, sort of it's a very, very sort of almost like a process you go through to be accepted into the ranks of management and also given a huge amount of responsibility and a huge amount of grief as a result as well. So it's not taken lightly, but that means that they handle HR differently. They handle organizational competencies differently. They handle all these boring things you talk about in corporate T's. It's the language of corporates, HR and incentives and blah, blah. But they do it different. They really do it different there. And then the puzzle that then you peel back the line and say, hold on, there's yet another mystery, which is how can they do this at scale? Because they've doubled and doubled. And so there's 60,000 or whatever it is now.
It's getting huge.
And it's getting huge. And that may work for 50. If it's Apple, it may work for 5,000. But suddenly, does it work for 50,000? So I really think that what Tim Cook spends his time mostly on is how do I keep my people happy, because how do I keep them to be productive in that way? And the sort of jobs also, I think, probably had the same priority, which is like we've got to keep these brilliant, talented people motivated. And I don't mean
I'd
that
say motivated rather than happy, because I think sometimes you make them making them sad.
I shouldn't have used the M word, because that's a corporate world word, but it's really happy. It's about pursuing the passion. And it's some of the clues, actually, of all places, come out of reading Creativity, Inc. by Catmull. So you start to see, oh, wow, look at that. There's like a whole dissertation in that book about how to keep creative people creative and manage creativity, which is like a very similar, not necessarily the same, but it's very similar to managing engineers. And I, you know, going back to my engineering days, you know, I used to have these arguments with people in liberal arts and saying that creativity is not missing out of engineers. Engineers are not boring people because of that, and so on. So it's kind of all comes back to this question of priorities, and I still think it's the biggest anomaly that they're doing things very differently. In fact, I would even go so far as to say that the biggest secret Apple has is how they do what they do. I mean, how they keep that machine running. And again, from conversations with ex-Apple people, it's very precarious. It's almost as it's a constant state of chaos, and keeping a lid on that and how to manage it. And that's all part of the magic. And I used to think that there was a formula. This is just simple. They've got it all written down somewhere. And I hear more and more that no, there is
kind of
no
just making up as they go along.
They're learning as Catmull did, you know, movie after movie, and probably that's what they're doing. Product after product, they're saying, okay, we learned a few things. Let's move forward, and that's again part of learning. Back to the question of longevity. So how do you get to live 100 years as a tech company?
Part of the thing that Catmull says too is that they're not always improving. Sometimes they screw up. Later on, they screw something else up.
You learn, and that's. Yeah. I think that they say that over and over again. Yeah. When you listen to management, everybody kind of completely glazes over because they talk about in these generalities, but I pay very close attention to those things because it turns out that that's what they're passionate about. So Tim Cook's passionate about his people. I believe that it's not just the old boilerplate.
Especially the op-ed that he wrote recently about Indiana.
Yeah, exactly. So he's becoming more activist. But I think as far as focusing on his own on what he does manage on a day-to-day basis, I think it's a people
those talks
question.
Are sincere.
Yeah, very sincere, and it's very important to pay attention. Also, same thing with Johnny Ive. Yeah. He sounds very academic or esoteric, but it's actually very pragmatic. What they're saying is very pragmatic, and it's a lesson for everybody.
Horace, thank you. I know we want to keep it like an hour because I could literally talk all evening with you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been a lot of fun, man.
A lot of fun too.
If people want to find you on the internet, where can they go?
I go by the name Asymco, Asymco. That's on my website.com or on Twitter at Asymco.
And you have the Asymco podcast and the Asymcar podcast.
The Asymco podcast is actually the Critical Path on 5x5. And yes, Asymcar is the other one we have as a hobby.
Yeah. One thing I actually did want to talk to you about, but it's going to take another hour, is air show.
Well, we got to talk about air show and also some of
the software side of it and the development.
There's a wonderful story because the we're pushing in new directions also on the question of how to deliver the stuff I think about.
Yeah. Which is a beautiful presentation.
The integration, the integration of the content and its presentation is actually part and parcel of what I do. So it's not just what I have to say, but rather I'm trying to innovate on the way I say it, and that means for us creating tools to actually do the.
Effective. I mean, there was people basically gasping in the audience as you were.
With static slides, you kind of see it for a second and forget about it, but you're moving and adjusting, and it's always snapping your attention back to what you're doing.
Yeah, motion, once you bring motion, that's one thing. So we're experimenting, you know, but one of the things we learned is that if you bring motion into data, it just changes from being a portrait to a movie.
Yeah,
it's a completely different thing. So once you get to movie, it's like, holy cow, we have to learn how to make movies now. So you start to think like a filmmaker. And it's a whole new area of open research. It's fantastic.
Well, one day we'll have you back because I want to talk
Absolutely.
Specifically about that.
Let's do that.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you again.
Horace.